yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber bands straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show, Alternative Visions. Okay, today's show, we're going to talk about education, K-12 education in America, and another dimension of the education crisis. I'd like to refer listeners to my forthcoming book, America's 10 Crises, and particularly a chapter on that, which is called The Privatization of the Educational System in America. I think I'm going to see if PRN can post that chapter up on its website so you can take a look at that. So privatization, we all know what privatization is. Instead of having the service a public good that's available to everybody, not based on whether you can buy it or not, privatization means you turn it over to the private sector and let the private sector make money off of it. And, of course, we know capitalism loves to make money off of every crook and cranny, creates crises, making money, and then makes money off of the crises it created. We all see that with the financial system going on here. And every little nook and cranny, instead of just expanding abroad to third world and merging markets and everything and making big money that way, it figures out how to make money locally by turning public goods into private goods. And that's what's happening with our educational system. Now, in this article or chapter of the book, what I argue is it's got to turn the teacher profession into an unskilled profession in order to complete the privatization of the public school system. Okay, privatizing means deprofessionalizing the teacher profession, turning teachers into skilled people who have control over the content and the delivery systems of their knowledge, into technology monitors. In other words, what's going to be taught will no longer be determined by the teachers. It will be determined by somebody else who writes the software. Oh, Bill Gates. Yes, and it will be standardized software. So teachers everywhere will teach the very same thing, and that thing will be in the software programs that will be taught. The lesson plans, in other words, that teachers develop will be developed for them. And the delivery systems will also be private. In other words, the technology in the classroom, monitors and so forth. And teachers will be monitor operators, equipment operators and so forth. Deprofessionalize them, because then you can really reduce the cost of teachers. And you will need far fewer of them. Does it sound like what goes on and has been going on in other occupations and sectors of the economy? Yes, exactly the same. But what's standing in the way is teacher unions and teacher contracts and the teachers themselves. So they have to be deprofessionalized. And you have to, therefore, destroy their unions, their contracts, and destroy collective bargaining for teachers itself. In other words, you must standardize the product in order to fully privatize and turn teaching, public school teaching, into a new massive profit center for hardware and software companies. Now, they say that, okay, we got to do this, we got to standardize the product because it's just not delivering the goods. In other words, blame the teachers for the problems in the school systems. And we see this everywhere. Teachers are under attack in America, everywhere. And the whole idea of being a teacher is being denigrated. You know, you go everywhere else in the world, and teachers have great respect, Latin America, Europe, and so forth, the people really respect their teachers because they know the teachers deliver something extremely important for their children and for the future. So here, though, you know, this so de-intellectualizing content of American culture is very strong. Of course, we see it with Tea Party. People typically think that, you know, to be intellectual, to be a professor, to be a teacher is something to be scorned. Part of our culture, I guess, in some ways. But anyway, standardizing the product is very important. Both the content of the product, what is taught, and the delivery system. In other words, the software and the hardware. Their view of the teacher and education problem is that we got to turn it into more technology, but that will turn it into more profits, of course, and we have to deprofessionalize the teacher profession. Okay, deprofessionalization means deunionization, and deunionization means you have to take apart and undermine teacher union contracts as a first step in this deprofessionalization. Now, we've had a decision here in California that's going to have great impact elsewhere across the country, both in California and elsewhere. And this is a recent decision last week by a high-level court in California called the Vergara, V-E-R-G-E-R-A, decision in Los Angeles, Los Angeles judge. And this should be viewed in the context of what I've just described as part of a growing offensive against the profession and against teachers and against their unions and against their contracts as part of this whole process to eventually turn teaching K through 12 into a unskilled hardware, software delivery kind of system where Bill Gates, no wonder Bill Gates is putting so much money into teaching and education reform. You know, this guy didn't become a multi-billionaire because of his altruistic reasons and objectives that he really wants to do something about education. No, this guy sees this as a big profit center going forward for his company, Microsoft, which is in trouble because of other developments, you know, software development in the cloud and so forth, the technology. We won't get into all that. But this last week we've had this decision, which is another milestone in this process of teacher displacement and deprofessionalization and the standardizing of the product. Capitalism always standardizes the product because that's how you get the cost down when you standardize it. Get the cost down, you can develop massive quantities of the unit of whatever the product is, and you make big profits by lower cost and larger volume of sales. That's how capitalism works. But first, you got to have a standardized product, and that means you got to deprofessionalize the service in order to standardize it. And that means, in turn, if you follow this thread, important thread, it means you got to destroy the teacher unions and the professional character of teaching as a service in this country. And that means you got to undermine and destroy these contracts. Because when you standardize the profit and deprofessionalize, you can get rid of teachers, right? Get rid of them. Well, what's standing in the way are the contracts and seniority and this thing called tenure, which is a kind of seniority element in teachers' contracts, a little different than in the private sector, but essentially it's the same thing. It's about job security. If you want to get rid of people in mass numbers, you got to undermine job security. We did this in the private sector here after 30 years by doing what? Offshoring of jobs, right? We destroyed the manufacturing sector in this country. We shipped jobs offshore, steel, auto, and so forth. Destroyed those unions, steel workers unions, auto workers unions. They once were the most powerful unions. They are now the weakest unions and barely holding on. Well, education is a service. You can't offshore it. So you got to deal with it in another way, another strategy to undermine it and deprofessionalize it. And that's what's going on here. And this decision has to be seen in the context of this bigger picture. And if you look at the last decade or so, there have been a number of initiatives by the elite in this country to do just that, to deprofessionalize, to standardize the product as a preliminary to all these other changes. What was No Child Left Behind under George Bush? An abortive effort to try to standardize the product. Okay, so it was their first initiative. Capitalists don't give up simply because the first strategy didn't work. They replaced that with race to the top, which was another approach that was designed to, okay, instead of trying to do the whole picture all at once, with No Child Left Behind, well, let's give some incentives, and let's see if we can develop some pilot projects to do that. And now we have the core curriculum movement, which is another thing in this whole tradition of standardizing the delivery system. Okay, so that's the background. And I want to talk with my guest here. I have a great guest here, Gretchen Lippo, a teacher. Let me tell you a little bit more about Gretchen. She's been a public school teacher for 40 years in New York City, the heart of the education beast, and in Alameda, California. She's been an active member of the California Teachers Association. She's been on the California Teachers Association State Council for decades. This is where policy is decided by teachers in the unions for 300,000 CTA teachers in California. And she's now the president of the Retired Teachers Association in Alameda and Contra Costa County, and very active still in Alameda community political projects. Okay. Are you there, Gretchen?
I'm here.
Okay. So we want to hear from Gretchen now about this decision, this important Vergara decision, this attack on teacher job security as a preliminary to destroying the contracts, to destroying the unions for teachers, as a preliminary to privatize, standardize, and deprofessionalize the teacher profession. I'm down the road. I'm not saying this is coming tomorrow. This is a long-term plan. You see, the elite in this country has plans going 10, 20 years in a whole number of areas, trade, taxes, and so forth. You know, they don't look at things election to election, you know, from Obama to from Bush to Obama. You know, these things are planned, and they may put their different spin on it, one candidate from the next, one Congress from the next, but they know where they're going, and they're feeling their way how best to do this, how to do this in the case of the education system, just like to do it with trade and with taxes and jobs and so forth. Okay, let's talk about that decision. I'm sure, Gretchen, you've looked at it in some
detail. I can tell you something about it, sure.
Yeah, tell us
first of all,
about the decision itself regarding tenure, and then tell us, you know, it seems to me this is a diversion from the real issue. Blame the teachers in order to obfuscate and confuse the issue so you can, they can move on with their plans.
Yeah.
What's
okay. So what we're calling this a meritless lawsuit brought on by Students Matter, an organization that was created by a Silicon Valley multimillionaire, David Welch.
Oh, connection to technology. Okay.
Yes,
wonderful.
That's right. Private and a public relations firm for the sole purpose of filing this suit. Students Matter, this is David Welch's outfit, is supported by Michelle Rhee and Students First. Another group.
Who is Michelle Rhee? Tell
me. Well, Michelle Rhee was the ex-superintendent of Washington, D.C., who was on the front page of the Time magazine with a big broom, who prided herself on sweeping out the bad teachers in Washington, D.C. And when a new mayor was elected, she went because that position was appointed by the mayor. So she transplanted herself to California, set up business in Sacramento. I think she's married to the mayor of Sacramento. And her agenda is to slowly privatize the schools in California. And, you know, she's got nothing good to say about the teacher organizations, about teachers, and she's become a nemesis to all of us who are concerned about real education. But let me get back to this other thing. They filed this lawsuit, this group called Students Matter, and it was filed against the state because the process for
Let me back up, just for the audience. Students Matter is an organization.
An organization that was set up by the multimillionaire David Welch.
By David Welch, okay.
Mm-hmm. It's not Michelle Rhee's group, but for all intents and purposes, it might as well have been. This is the group he set up and filed a suit in Los Angeles. And the suit challenges California statutes. Its statutes governing due process in teacher dismissals using experience as a criteria during school layoffs and the 2-year probationary period for teachers. In California, you teach your first 2 years really without a contract, and you can be let go at any moment during those 2 years with no questions asked, no paperwork. Once you pass the 2 years, if and when you pass it, then you are under the tenure statutes governing tenure. And this whole thing about tenure is really a misnomer. You don't have a job for life. If there's a question of incompetency, there's a process set up where the manager of the school, which is usually a vice principal or a principal, must document what the issues are and notify the teacher. The teacher will generally then bring in a union attorney. And I've seen this before in my experience, that when there is an incompetent teacher and they go through the process, that teacher leaves or is fired, if you want to use
okay,
that word.
So tenure, there's no guarantee of job.
No
forever.
Guarantee. That's
okay,
right.
Well, most
guarantee.
People aren't aware of that.
And you can be fired,
and people are being fired
that's
who
right.
can't perform. And if you can't do your job, you shouldn't have
that's
your
right.
job. I would agree with that.
Yeah. And that's what's happened, and that's what I've seen. And in my experience, sure, I saw a bad teacher here and there. Why wouldn't I in 40 years? But when there was a serious issue, and the school management was on top of it, which is not always the case, but when they're on top of it, and they go through the process, that teacher is gone. And I'm not talking about things like, sexual or physical abuse. That is the law outside of education, you know. And so we're not talking about that. Those issues do come up, and those folks are taken care of by virtue of the statutes beyond the teaching profession.
Mm.
So anyway, they brought this case. It's been bubbling for a few months, and we've been watching it in the union and really getting a sense of what was up ahead, because we could just see the parties coming together with all this money, which tells you, this is the agenda.
How much
the
money?
The lawsuits highlighted the wrong problems. It's proposed the wrong solutions. Lawsuit was not about helping students, but another attempt by millionaires and corporate folks in Silicon Valley to undermine our profession and push the agenda on California public schools, through charters.
Do we know how
charters.
Much money, Gretchen, excuse me for your interview, do we know how much money Welch and this Student Matters organization put into
this? Don't have an actual number on, but this Welch is a billionaire. Let's see, he's head of some outfit in Silicon Valley, and we could probably check that out, but...
Okay, we can look. We
not
can
only
that,
that
later.
But then they
right.
hired a very fancy, high-profile media specialist to get the word out. So anyway, this is the first step. The unions will be appealing this, of course. It has to go to the Court of Appeals and the State Supreme Court. And both teacher unions in California, and by the way, we're just talking about we're talking about K-12. We're not talking about higher education. That's where they have real tenure. K-12 teachers do not have real tenure in the sense that their job is guaranteed for life. So both unions, California Federation of Teachers and the California Teachers Association, have joined together. They are working on this cooperatively. They have the same attorney and team. And they will, of course, will be appealing it. There were 9 plaintiffs, and 4 of them didn't even testify. And according to the documents I received from the teachers, they said that they even claimed one teacher in Pasadena who was named Teacher of the Year was, a bad teacher. Now, I don't know anything more than that, but it was the students were, the five students who did testify, you know, sat up there and talked about the bad teachers they had. So, you know, you have to imagine, you know, you put kids together and you ask them, tell me about your bad teachers. Boy, you could just pick up all kinds of information. Is it all accurate? Hardly. You know, kids love to, you know, share their, you know, what they're going to say about teachers that have been teaching them, you know.
It's a practice now to let the students evaluate teachers, and of course, if you didn't get a good grade, I mean, it's your chance to slam your teacher,
get back.
You know.
That's right.
So I mean,
yes.
If we had that kind of a statisticians use that kind of data in their statistical estimates, it would be thrown out as a bogus survey, you know.
That's right.
But anyway,
the court decision says that this process is unconstitutional. It's the state system they use for evaluating and dismissing bad teachers. The court ruling is that it's unconstitutional, and they don't give a remedy at this point. They're not looking at factors of poverty, and that seems, I think that's one of the biggest factors to determine where schools are in trouble, where teachers are having a hard time, and where most teachers don't want to teach. It's difficult enough to teach in a high-performing school. When you're in a community where the kids have not had an educational background, it's very difficult, and they get out very quickly. The turnover is very, rapid. So
you're putting your finger on something very important here, and that is that teachers are increasingly being evaluated, and this decision will push it even further in that direction, based upon the test scores that students get. In other words, the teacher in the classroom is the sole determinant of how the student performs, and it has the student performance has nothing to do with society or culture or their home environment or any other factor. It's totally the responsibility. I mean, if the student has psychological problems or family problems or divorces or so, of course that student is not going to be able to perform, you know, but yet the teacher is considered the sole determinant of that, which is just nonsense. But it's a way of blaming the teacher for all of the ills of society and all the other problems of the educational system. Now, this development of teacher evaluation based on student scores and grades is something that's developing regardless of what we're talking about with this particular decision.
That's right.
And the audience should listen carefully, because what you said, this decision, unconstitutionality, is not just the tenure system is unconstitutional, correct me if I'm wrong, but that the whole process of evaluating teachers is unconstitutional. Is that correct?
Well, the issue that you're hitting on is the evaluating a teacher based on the performance of the students. And when you look at the classrooms across the nation, you will find classrooms where half of the students do not speak English, and so are not going to do well on a test. You wouldn't expect them to do well on a test. Many classrooms have kids that are poor, or homeless, or they don't have the right background or the right opportunities at home with books and families that, you know, process education for them. And you hear this over and over again, you know, well, whose fault is it? Well, you know, it's a cultural problem, and we haven't addressed that. In schools where you have difficult students, you need to have a smaller class size. You need to have some kind of a safety net. You need some kind of counselors who will go between the school and the home. You need a way to bring the parents into the school. So when I was on a teacher on special assignment, and I had to work in developing programs for kids who didn't speak English. When I first started teaching, there was to be no foreign language in the schools, and that was before the Lau versus Nichol decision in 1974. And after that, the Supreme Court said, you've got to teach kids in a language that they can understand. Well, I'll be darned. So we had to set up labs with people who were bilingual, basically. And so part of the part of what we had to do is bring the families together and reach out. Immigrant parents tend not to want to come into the schools, don't want to get involved, don't know how to get involved, and so forth. So we had to break those barriers down. But once we did, you know, we had a very rich kind of program where the families came in on special occasions. We had an ongoing council of parents and teachers, and the whole dynamics changed, and that made a big difference. And you could also then listen to what the kids had to say. Many immigrant kids don't even want to talk. They don't even want to tell you what's going on. So if you're a teacher in classrooms like this, your test scores are not going to reflect what, you know, the test scores of my own children who went to schools where, you know, where everybody was English speaking. So that makes no sense to evaluate the competency of a teacher based on the outcome of the kids that are still in the process of being educated. And that has been a fight, and that continues to be a fight, because if you want to have good public education, you've got to have teachers who come into the schools, who are committed to the schools, who want to stay there. And when teachers are under attack, this is not a profession that is attracting competent people. Who wants to, you know, the pay isn't that good. The pay is,
Where's a starting teacher in California?
Well, it depends on the district, but, you know, around 50,000. You know, maybe 45, 50. And then in order to, you know, you move up every year. By the time you retire, you know, at the end of your career, 25, 30 years, most teachers retire after about 25 years. Your pay is almost double what your starting pay was. But that, you know, that depends. Maybe 80. Maybe the top is 80, 85.
Well, if we turn teachers into monitor operators, I'm sure we can pay them far less than professional rates of pay, you know, but that was my earlier point. Exactly what is tenure in the California system, and how does that tenure play a role in this teacher evaluation process?
Well, tenure just means that after the 2 years of probation, you become tenured. That means that you've got a job that you don't are not serving at the whim of someone, the boss, the principal, the vice principal, and that if the school manager determines that you are incompetent, it needs to be performance based. By the way, it can't just because you're pretty or you're rich or whatever. It has to be performance-based. Then they meet with the teacher. I have a face-off on, look, these are the issues I've seen. This is why I think you aren't doing what you're supposed to be doing, blah, blah, blah. And then that manager has to begin to document. It's got to be evidence-based, you know. I saw this happen. I saw that happen. I saw so that as the process goes through this period. Now, if a person's really incompetent, and I've seen this, then the principal has to move quickly and be on top of it. That's what principals are for. And so meeting up with them, the teacher gets a union representative or an attorney to see that the process is being followed fairly. And then at the end, goes to a hearing panel and determines if that finding is accurate or not. And as I say, when I've seen it carried out, it works as far as terminating incompetent teachers.
Well, you know, what you described to me sounds no different than what exists in a union agreement in the private sector, except that private sector agreements don't give 2 years of probation. In other words, they can fire you anytime for no reason, no explanation. That's what probation is all about. It's usually 30 to 90 days probationary period in the private sector. But in other words, here, administrators, managers in education system can fire you anytime for any reason. And certainly after 2 years, they can know whether you're a competent teacher or not.
So
it sounds like they even have more leeway to get rid of non-performing teachers in the education profession than they even do in. And it sounds to me that when you talk about tenure, you're really just talking about this process of okay, after 2 years, you can still get fired if you're not performing. That
That's
doesn't
right.
sound like a guaranteed job for life.
No, not at all.
Which
not
is a bullshit way of defining tenure. Yeah. It's not that at all. It's just the same process that you find in other union agreements in the private sector, except it's even weaker in terms of the teacher, right? So why do we still have this claim that teachers, we have all these incompetent teachers if administrators can get rid of them?
That's a good question. I mean, that's why we're taking the broad view and we're saying this just looks like another attack on public schools, as you mentioned when you first came on the air. It's just another attack to privatize, to get a hold of the finances. You know, there's a lot of money that goes between the state and the schools. They started out trying to get this through the vouchers plan about 15, 20 years ago. Well, that didn't work, so then they started the charter. Oh, let's have charter schools.
Oh, yes, I forgot to mention charter. That's, an abrupt way of creating pilot privatized on the fringes and see how it works, and then you can spread it. You know, let me just make a comment here. What are charter schools? Charter schools are the same thing in the education system that was used in the 1970s to bust the construction unions. How did they bust the construction unions? They set up what was called double-breasted operations. In other words, the company that had a union contract set up a non-union company in parallel to it, and hired non-union people, and over time simply moved the work from the union contract to the non-union, double-breasted, two-sided, and then that way undermined, scared the workers in the construction unionized sector so they would agree to wage cuts and so forth. That's how they busted the construction unions in the 70s and 80s, and this charter school thing is the same thing in education.
That's right. There's some nuances on that, though, however. In districts that set up charter schools, the teachers can actually petition to be part of the union. So we have, in this town where I live, we have a charter school where everybody in the school is unionized. When they started out, this whole idea was, well, you know, we're going to be our own outfit, and we're going to just do what we want to do, and it was a small group of teachers and administrators, and soon enough they realized that they needed a system, and the teachers were feeling abused, and so they petitioned and became a union. So they're now wrecked. So some charter schools are unionized, and some are not.
Let's use the charter schools as an example. Now, the charter schools, they don't have, quote, tenure, right?
Unless they've negotiated it because they wanted to be part of the union,
they can pick up
the contract.
Let's assume, you know, massively the charter schools don't have unions. Some of them do. Most of them don't. Now, okay, so there's no unions there, meaning there's no tenure there. Do the charter schools perform in terms of student evaluations better than the unionized schools?
There's been a bunch of studies done on this, and they found it's not the case at all.
Rid of tenure doesn't necessarily mean you're going to improve performance.
That's right.
Which means the whole tenure thing is a diversion from the real issues.
Unfortunately, sometimes the charter school itself sort of carries the illusion that this is a special school. Well, yeah, all schools are special, especially to the parents whose kids are there. But when you look at the results of the test scores, that doesn't play out. And the other problem with some of the charter schools is the independent ones, as they can pick and choose who's going to go to that school. You know,
but their performance still isn't any better than public schools on average.
They're not going to let normal kids and across range of normal kids. They can cherry pick the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something going on in charter schools. Charter schools often start up with a very passionate group of parents and teachers who have a vision that just give us the school and we're just going to make this into something whoop-de-doo. And, you know, with that attitude, it happens, you know, to begin with, but it doesn't last because the kids move on and the parents move on. And it's so it does that kind of bravado doesn't last. But the scores do not show that charter schools excel over the regular public schools. I taught in a continuation school, which tended to be poor kids, some homeless kids, students who didn't do well in the regular school. But the beauty of this was the class sizes were so small, you know, no more than 15 kids a class. I got to know every one of these kids very, very well, and they knew they wanted to graduate from high school. The relationship was totally different than in the regular high school down the street where there's a class size max of 150 kids a day. These teachers have 150 student contacts a day. Now, I tell you, teaching English, you're going to read 150 papers a night. I mean, it's just beyond, I mean, it's enough to wear people out. Where you have special school set up and special class size ratios, and you have more resources, and you have a counselor, somebody who can intervene, find out what's going on with the kids, they need money, glasses, whatever. It makes a difference, but that's what's needed if you're going to turn schools around that are in low-performing areas, and that's what this is aimed at. And I can't understand how this ruling is going to reach out and all of a sudden catapult these schools into success. And
so what you're telling me is the studies show, first of all, that charter schools where there is no tenure have no difference in performance.
That's right.
Overall.
That's
and,
right.
But secondly, you are telling me that performance does improve dramatically, both in more wealthy neighborhoods and in the poor urban neighborhoods, when the class size is small and students
sure.
can get individual attention. So
right.
that's the solution. Is what
mm-hmm.
you am I correct
right.
in summarizing that? Is
yes.
that what the studies show, that smaller classes and more
mm-hmm.
attention is the solution to increasing student performance?
Well, yes, I think those are very important factors for improving student performance, but I don't see any of that kind of data that involved in this case at all.
Well,
what they're trying
okay.
to show is kids getting up on the stand and saying, well, I had a terrible teacher. You know, my classroom was out of control, they quoted one student. Well, I'm saying, why is that classroom out of control? Where is the management of that school? Are you know, what's going on here? And just to say, well, it's because you've got a lousy teacher. There's an argument that the administrators make is, oh, it just takes so long to, get rid of a teacher who isn't doing well. Well, I just don't agree with that at all. You have to go through some paperwork, yeah, and you've got to get in there and observe so you can give some evidence why you're making the determination you're making. But, you know, it's not rocket science. It means it's got to be evidence-based, that's all. And I think, I have to say, management must be pretty darn lazy. They don't want to do that kind of job. They just want to,
blame the teachers. They want to blame the
yeah,
teachers.
Yeah, and, they, and
of,
you know, then they
instead
transfer.
Instead of administrators doing their job, like all managers should do
their job. They transfer a bad
job,
teacher to another
you know,
school. Let that
right,
school take care of
them. It. Document it, and
that's
you know,
right.
if someone's
that's
not
right.
performing, then document the non-performance,
right.
and if they're not doing their job, you know, other workers are the first to say that some of their colleagues who don't perform should be let go, because a poor-performing colleague means they got to do someone else's
that's
job.
Right.
Right?
They have to pick up the slack.
All workers know that. All workers know that. That if you're not pulling your weight, you shouldn't be here because I'm going to have to pull your weight. And no one defends somebody that's not doing their job. And it sounds to me like administrators aren't doing their job, that they have the tools here to evaluate, but for who knows what sociological reasons, they want to not do their job, not really deal with teachers who aren't doing their job, but they have the process already to do it. Why aren't they doing their job is the question.
Maybe they're just lazy and that's what they thought they were going to do when they left the classroom so they could take charge of a school, that it was going to be quote-unquote easier. And they found out it wasn't going to be easier, might even be more difficult. But, you know, in every California school is a system called PAR, Peer Assistance and Review. And it's been set up with a surplus money that came out of a bubble about 15 years ago that principals can refer a teacher to this group. This is available all over the state. So you refer a teacher to this group. Someone in the PAR group, and I was in the first PAR in my school district, and I would assign to go help a teacher who was having trouble. And I would go to the school, find out, go into the classroom. I would talk to the teacher ahead of time, of course. But this is how the system works. So someone's assigned to help this teacher figure out what it is they're having problems with. Maybe their room is a mess. They don't know how to organize their stuff. Maybe they don't understand the curriculum and the sequence and the most effective way to teach it. And so this person works with the teacher. And there's no, the administration isn't brought in on this. This is just between the teacher and the peer assistant. So then what happens is as the teacher gets more and more help from a peer, it reflects on how the teachers perform by the principal. So the principal should be able to see some improvement. I found in my own experience that teachers who were struggling in the classroom, you know, were not, you know, there was no, just they had no conversation with their site principal. Because I say, has your principal talked to you? Have you talked to them? No. Well, you know, if you don't have conversations with the people you're responsible for, you know, how can you help them? How can you improve the situation? I think there's just sort of a natural tendency on the part of the management to say, gosh, I don't know what to do about that person, so I just won't do anything. You know, I'm shy, I'm timid, I'm afraid if I say something, well, whatever. Anyway,
in the private sector, if you were a manager with that attitude, you'd be fired.
Yeah, that's right. And I did see some of that in my experience, where a strong superintendent came in and shook his fingers to everybody and said, I'm watching all of you. And that means the principals, because he's the one that evaluates the principals. Where there was a strong superintendent who sent a message that, you know, everybody was on the same standards, yeah, things did happen. And when this superintendent said, anybody out there have a problem with somebody, come and see me, everybody kind of straightened up and said, oh, my gosh, I better take some responsibility for what's going on here. So when you put a lot of people together to work together, and then you throw in a whole mess of kids and you've got to take care of them, that is a big challenge. But it can be done, and I've seen it. Of successful programs over and over again when you have a committed staff. So, you know, when you read a case like this and you think, oh, my God, what is going on? To have that kind of money in politics and money in education being thrown at the system, you know, there's something out of whack. I was very disturbed to see that, oh, Arnie Duncan thought this was a great, you know, education of Secretary of Education, Obama's man.
Arnie Duncan is the
Secretary of Education.
Okay, good.
National.
Right, for the Obama administration, who has always been for charter schools and privatization and attack teachers and strip their contracts and so forth. This guy is, right out of a right-wing Republican administration here.
Mm-hmm.
No,
well, he was Obama's man, and he thought it was a good decision. Yes, and Obama's been a big embrace of charter schools. According to the little NEA bulletin I just got, that apparently there is a division within the Democratic Party on whether this is a good ruling or not. They can't agree on this. So,
what are the two positions?
The first position is this is a good ruling. We got to get rid of the tenure laws. And the other is, wait a minute, if there's some problems here, let's deal with this legislatively. Since these were enacted by, in this case, California State Legislature. So those are the two positions. One is to, okay, can we strengthen this law? Can we make it better? The process, can we make it better? That's one. And the other is, we'll just get rid of the whole thing. And just, because the logic of this decision is, okay, you're the principal. You don't like that teacher? No problem. Just go tell him to get lost. The remedies have not been forthcoming. In other words, this is the first ruling, and they haven't really come in with the remedies yet on, well, what are you going to do? How are you going to set up the process?
Oh, so this decision simply says teacher tenure.
It's unconstitutional.
Get rid of it, and then it says, okay, well, doesn't say anything. What do you do about it?
Doesn't say anything. That's right. So, yeah, what do you do about it? You know, all these things have been worked out over time. We got collective bargaining in 1975, so we're looking at, 25, 35 years of collective bargaining. And these processes have been set up over time between teachers and school districts, between teachers and legislators. They've been, developed and honed. And here we are now, all of a sudden, you get these millionaires from Silicon Valley, and they pick up a big, they pick up a rock and just throw it, crash. And that's going to straighten it all out. Give me a break. So
bottom line, what we're saying is firing teachers by getting rid of the tenure law, which it doesn't really change anything. You still have to have a process. Firing
that's
bad
right.
teachers... won't really close the achievement gap? Is that what we're saying?
That's right. I mean, there's no guarantee that that's going to happen.
Because
and that hasn't even been addressed.
By a whole number of factors that have a lot more to do with other developments and conditions than just teacher tenure.
Quote, unquote, bad teachers.
Bad teachers,
you know, I have to say, in my 40 years, I saw very few what I would call bad teachers. I saw teachers that were young and struggling. I saw teachers who they needed a teacher to teach physics. They couldn't find one, so they took a math teacher and said, teach physics. Well, and the kids all said, I'm not learning physics. Well, yeah, because the teacher's teaching out a credential, but they didn't have anybody to teach that subject. So there were some mismatches there, which constitutes some problems.
And that seems like a major problem in the inner urban schools.
That's right. It sure is.
Because both administrators and teachers are reluctant to teach in the inner schools because of the conditions and problems at inner urban schools. So you get the most inexperienced teachers. So it's a question of not tenure, but maybe teacher inexperience.
That's a big piece of it. Yeah, that's a big piece of it. We had I teach in a town that has a big Navy base. And the base closed down, and the military left. And under the federal laws, when that happens, they have to turn over the housing there that they use for the military to the homeless, battered women, Native Americans, a whole group of people that are poor. And so that happened, and 500 people came into that area, and a lot of them brought their children that had never been in ongoing school programs, and that school had tremendous difficulty dealing with children just acculturating them to a classroom situation. So they hired a couple of young, lovely people. These two teachers stayed for a month and said, I can't do this. I just can't do this. Well, you know, I went down and I saw it with my own eyes. So what we had to do was we had to put two teachers, and we asked some of our folks who had just retired if they would come back to help get these kids settled in to a school setting. And so we hired two teachers, two recently retired teachers, in those classrooms. But the new, young, dynamic, excited teachers, they just weren't going to do it. They could see that it was going to be something they weren't prepared to handle. And you don't do that to somebody who's not ready for that sort of thing. You know, they're all pumped up with coming out of college.
It seems like there has to be some sort of solution to this inner-city achievement gap problem. That does something about bringing, luring, and private providing incentives and other changes to bring the best teachers into the inner schools.
That's right.
Of an important solution to this than this cover thing of getting rid of tenure, which isn't going to change the achievement gap in the inner city schools whatsoever.
Nope. There have to be other ways to address this. Serious, serious resources coming in to really make a difference. Otherwise, this isn't going to make any difference. It will demoralize teachers.
So attacking teacher tenure is just a way of avoiding addressing the real problem.
It's a distraction, exactly. And, you know, bringing all these big rich guys in to solve the problem, you know, what in the hell does that say? Is that any way to run the schools, is to turn it over to somebody who's got a lot of money and file a lawsuit?
Well, maybe David Welch wants to make a name for himself to run for political office.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably what's behind Welch's
He's already made a name for himself. Yeah. So, anyway, we will be this is going on appeal, and we're going to be paying a lot of attention to this. There'll be a lot of focus on this issue. If something good comes out of it, it's only because there's a realization you've got to deal with the real issue and not just blaming some bad teachers.
Or blaming a process that really isn't an obstacle in the first place to the whole thing.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right.
All right. What do you know about this whole decision sort of catching fire elsewhere in the country? We're going to see a lot more court
decisions
elsewhere.
Well, I think there's some talk about, they're doing this in California. Now we're going to do it in, I think I saw something about it in Minnesota. Let's do it there. You know, there'll be, this will catch on. And I think that the California tenure process is probably one of the better ones. You know, we still have about 10 states that don't have collective bargaining for public school teachers. So it's not an issue there. But sure, you know, they see a hot item here and people are going to talk about it there. Maybe we should just... So I am going to the National Education Association convention coming up in Denver in about 3 weeks. I'm going to go and watch that, and there'll be a lot of talk about this, and there will be teachers from all over the country, and they'll weigh in on this. We'll hear a lot about this and find out, well, what do other states have in mind?
Mm-hmm. Can we get you to come back after that conference?
Sure.
And
that'd be great.
What are the teachers' response to all this?
That's right.
That would be interesting.
Okay.
Yes.
Yep. All right. Be happy to do that.
Yeah, let's plan on that. So, teacher tenure, the whole tenure thing, it seems to me, too, tenure is something outside the union contract. The union contract does not say
that's
tenure.
Right.
The union contract talks about, there should be a due process that everyone understands for challenging teachers that aren't doing their job and giving them a fair opportunity to respond and so forth. That's due process. So they're attacking due process outside the teacher contract. But I predict that if they move forward and eliminate tenure, then they will move, they, meaning the elites, the Welches and their political friends like Michelle Lee and so forth, will move on and will then take a shot at provisions in the union contract that have to do with union seniority and transfer rights and so on and so forth. That's the logical next step for this attack on these processes that protect teachers, give them some basic rights. We're not going to see the end of this simply because they're attacking tenure. This is the beginning of the of a process, I believe, to dismantle union contracts in the teacher profession in order to do what I was talking about at the very beginning of the show, deprofessionalize the profession and standardize the product and make it a big profit center for Bill Gates and David Welch and all these technologists, billionaires, who have an awful lot of money to make in doing this long term.
Or they themselves may want to run for office. This is a platform they can jump off of.
That's right. That's right.
I've seen that more than, they'll want to show up. I think we all think that Michelle Reed would like very much to run for state superintendent.
Yeah, and I bet that's why she's
school.
In Sacramento. I bet that's why she moved to Sacramento. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have this phenomenon today of billionaires running more overtly for office and becoming much more active, throwing their money at elections and at propositions and initiatives and all these other developments. Billionaires, you know, in politics more so than ever before. And I don't know, this Welch guy smells to me like one of these opportunists here looking to fix his own career and his own bottom line for his company. I don't know what he makes. Is he a software guy or hardware? Yeah, David. Well, we can find out. Yeah, anyway, he's in Silicon Valley, so he must be software. So to sum up here, it sounds to me, you give your sum up view of what this decision is all about and what it means, where it's going, and then
it's another attack on public education. It's a sort of like a silver bullet. Oh, we found the silver bullet. It's a bunch of bad teachers. All we have to do is shoot them and get them out of the way, and public schools will just take off. Mm. So it's another one of those on the road to trying to privatize public schools. And we have to just gear up, pay attention, fight back, and keep our eye on this and get to know who these characters are and monitor wherever you're living in whatever city, town, or state, and keep your eye on this stuff because it simmers before it hits. You know, this has been bubbling along, but people didn't know it was going on unless they were, you know, in the union like us watching it. But it hit on the 10th of June when the decision came down. So everyone should keep an eye on California because this is going to be in the courts for some time to come.
Mm-hmm. And folks should understand that these silver bullets, as you call them, not only have no effect, but behind this is an ignoring of the real problem and providing real solutions. I mean, there is an underachievement problem in the urban city schools, no doubt, and there's many reasons for that, many of them cultural, sociological, and so forth, but it seems that the problem solution should address what the problem conditions really are. Tenure is just an obfuscation, a diversion issue here, and those who are attacking, you know, the tenure issue, what are they proposing for other solutions to the inner city school performance achievement gap? You know, nothing.
They aren't.
Nothing. I don't hear anything from these folks, which makes me very suspicious of what their motives really are. You know, they're not really addressing the real issue.
Jack, I need to say is, you know, if there are parents out there listening, go to the school board and watch the process. You know, go to your school PTA. Listen, being a good citizen takes a little work here. But, you know, I'm watching my school board, and they want to put on this huge multi-billion-dollar bond, you know. And, you know, there's all kinds of stuff going on right under your nose, and you got to get up from the TV and get out there and go to some of these meetings and pay attention to see what's really happening and how your school district is working.
Right, and how they're spending their money. Are they spending it?
That's right. How are they spending it? What are the salaries of these characters that are running
your
district?
Where is the money going? Is it going
That's
for more
right.
and more administrators and raises and benefits for administrators,
right.
or is it going to improve the classroom condition for
That's
these
right.
students? That's the big big development I think you ought to look for if you're going to go to the school board meetings. Dig into that. Find out. I think you'll find out that administrators are doing better than ever, not
better
doing
than
their
ever.
Job. Not doing
yep.
their job, which they should be doing if a teacher is not performing.
That's right.
They have all the tools to deal with low-performing teachers, but they're not doing it. And the real problems are not really being addressed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is Alternative Visions. I think we've run out of time. Thank you, Gretchen.
Okay, very good.
Next
have
week.
A good one.
Bye.
Nice
Bye-bye.
Talking to all of you. Bye-bye.